to the ashes of the Imperium.
Hello and welcome to Ashes of the Imperium. My name is Dan, and once again, I'm joined by the wonderful Steve. How are you, Steve?
Yeah, very good, mate. Doing good.
Excellent. You're not suffering from the murder curse then?
No. I've had the inoculation for that, so I should be fine.
Glad to hear it. So, of course, we are today talking all about Arcs of Omen Angron, the second book in this exciting new narrative campaign series. And this is, as the title suggests, centered on the returning demon Primarch. We've got a wonderful new model for him as well.
Yeah, it's just epic. And I think it's interesting, there's a piece of the concept art from the book that's going around on social media, and it's just like literally him being...
Is it him looming?
Yes.
It's him looming out of the clouds, out of the smoke. Kind of, someone compared it to a very Godzilla-esque
thing. Yeah, no, definitely some sort of kaiju coming out.
Exactly.
And it's like... las beams and las cannons all firing into him and stuff like that. But I think the model fits really well. I've not seen it in the flesh, but I think from the pictures we've seen, it looks mighty enough. It looks pretty big.
Yeah, it certainly is chunky. And do you know what? Before we crack on a little bit with the book, one of the things that I was thinking about Angron is the scale. So, like, you've obviously got a model, and a model's just a representation. And, you know, if you look at things like rhinos, they don't necessarily look like they could fit 10 Space Marines inside them. Sure, whatever. But for me, as I'm reading this book, and it's got a lot of Angron in it, I struggle to kind of reconcile the scale that the art puts him at and, like, the scale of him taking actions within the story. So, like... there's a scene where he kind of, it's like, you know, Angron is on the bridge of his flagship. And it's just like, well, the picture on the other side of the page is of him as tall as a skyscraper. Like, how is he, like, sat on the bridge of his ship? I suppose he's a demonic entity, so perhaps he's the size of whatever he needs to be the size of. But yeah, the scale of Angron kind of, like, threw me a little bit.
Yeah, I guess the dimensions are flexible because he is a demon, and some of the things we hear him, see him do. I think one of the good things about this book is we kind of get to see inside his head, because a lot of it is from his point of view. And it's not just all, you know, it is an interesting insight. Yes, you know, he just basically just goes and fight everyone, but that's fine. We know that's what he does, but... I think for me, it just gives him a little bit more personality than perhaps his stat line.
Yeah, I think that's something I feel that you can kind of struggle with characters like Angron, is if you do see them as just like, you know, the whole like meme blood for the blood god rage machine, which, you know, clearly is an entity that is fueled by rage and hatred. But if you just see him as just that, then it's quite difficult to, I suppose, relate to him. And obviously, as humans, we do like to relate to human stories. That's certainly something that I found myself kind of wondering as I'm reading the book, is that the tragic nature of the character is something that you kind of like gets alluded to and revealed sort of a little bit towards the end. Whereas the first part of the book, I felt like it was just kind of like raw Angron smash type stuff.
Yeah, and his anger is fueled by something we'll talk about in a minute. But it was good also that we got Vashtar appearing as well. So it didn't feel just like a total aside. That
no,
we were still, even though he was the thread, the central thread of this. We were still part of the whole Arcs of Omen, so I thought that
absolutely.
Was
absolutely. And in fact, let's that's an excellent segue, Steve, onto the book itself and the story. So I suppose we should have like the kind of the voice, like previously on Arcs of Omen. you know, as Steve's just mentioned, you've got, you know, Abaddon and Vashtar, the Arcophane. They're hunting for something called the Key, and the Key is described in the book as something to open a metaphysical lock. In order to unleash an ancient weapon of galaxy-altering power. So that's curious. I wonder what that will look like as and when we get to the end of this narrative arc. What do you think the ancient weapon of galaxy altering power is going to be, Steve?
Don't know.
The power of friendship.
Of forgiveness. I don't know. I think it'd be a bit disappointing if it was just a different shaped axe or something. I think it needs to be something more arcane, perhaps. Yeah, I think the fact we've still got plenty of these components to find, which is where all the arcs are being sent out to uncover. And, you know, even spoilers, you know, what gets discovered here isn't particularly fully described. So I think we're still being kept a little bit in the dark as to what that's finally going to be or how it operates. Or, but we're
definitely referring here to the Coral engine, or do you mean what is ultimately found right at the end?
Yeah, right at the end.
Ah, okay, okay. I was going to say, like, well, I'm not sure the Coral engine is going to feature very much in the narrative anymore. but yeah, we'll get onto that.
She got a broom.
Yeah, a Hoover, more like.
Yeah, space Hoover.
So, right, cool. So that's the background. You know, Abaddon, Vashtor and the Bale fleets, the Ark Swim, and all that jazz, looking for all the various key fragments to unlock this super weapon.
Yes.
And this aspect of the story theoretically centers on the flagship, the Stygian Heart, the Ark of Omen, the Stygian Heart, and the Bale fleet around it. And it's sort of captained by a Chaos Lord, Apophari Quen, from the Scourged. And the Scourge are an excellent Chaos Warband. Love to the kind of the vibe of the Scourge. And I think they are cursed to hear every single lie ever told. That's a bit dark, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I think that's really cool. Like, and obviously they're very Zeechy, this lot. So I think they're quite a nice kind of foil to the kind of single-minded Cornish hatred of Angeron. So it's quite cool to see them featured. But that's basically how the book starts. It's Stygian Heart, the Bale fleet goes in, and they're attacking this an astropathic hub fortress of a planet called Malak Bael.
Yes,
which flows off the tongue. And why is this an astropathic hub fortress, Steve?
Because we have something that has been unearthed, an ancient site that's been unearthed by a Inquisitor, and she's kind of worked out how to switch it on, which is basically by plugging in lots of batteries, or which in this case is psychers.
Ah, just like the Astronomicon.
Yes. Just plug enough of them in, get enough voltage going through it, and basically powered up this thing, which is called the Coral Engine. And we get quite a lot of detail on it, which is cool. I mean, you know, like how it kind of operates, how it works, where it is. Bit of a floor plan. We all love a floor plan, right, kids?
Any form of maps.
Yes, exactly. And I think the way this is introduced is really nice, because we don't get told it straight away as such, but what we get is Angeron basically can see off in the distance this burning white hot kind of witchcraft, and it's driving him nuts. It's like, this can't exist. This is bad. And that's actually like a beacon that draws him in. I think that's quite a nice way of doing it. He's not looking to explain anything. He can just see this kind of what starts off as a bit of an itch at the corner of his eye, which turns out to be something that just, I think, actually empowers him at some stages of the story.
Yeah, there's a pretty critical moment that we'll get to where that is quite interesting. For me, the coolest thing about the Coral Engine is like the kind of side stuff. So yes, it's booted up to be almost like a kind of like mini Astronomicon to help with all the madness of the warp, and you know, ships were going missing and getting delayed and all that warpy stuff. So that they fired it up and it's kind of acting as a bit of a warp beacon to help direct warp travel. But this is quite interesting. So the Core Engine's focusing vein was directed towards Shveda 2 with the intent of sending an astropathic message to check if further reinforcements were required. Yet, as the invisible psychic radiance of the engine enveloped the world, loyalist battle psychers all across Shvedor 2, so that's an interesting name, Shvedor, they found their powers augmented. Drawing upon the sudden reserve of psychic might, the armies of the God Emperor surged to victory on that world in less than a week. Here was the line-breaking assault that eventually collapsed the heretic defences to the system. And if the loyalist psychers on Shvedel 2 were burnt out and slain by their miraculous exertions, that only made them glorious martyrs in their comrades' eyes. So I like the fact that it's kind of like... Yeah, it's win. It's like the witches are all burning, good. And we're winning, so... Glorious martyrs in their comrades' eyes.
Yeah, no, I think for me, you know, that we're talking about it being a completely different part of the sector. This isn't just torchlight shining down the corridor. This is a proper piece of kit that has incredible power. But yeah, I'm not sure we entirely know kind of who made it. I mean, I think it's hinted at it's back from the Age of Darkness, but it's obviously incredibly powerful. It's a bit of a twist we don't not really seen before. I think something that big and powerful.
Yeah, it's fairly significant. Well, it has to be significant for the Grey Knights to get involved, because they do get involved, don't they?
Oh yes, so they have a bit of a check the old tea leaves and discover that something's going to be happening there, and have all sorts of they sort of scry all sorts of doom and gloom happening there. So they do pull their meager numbers together and get their sharpish to kind of say, look, it's all going to go Pete Tong. We really need to get the defenses sorted. And it's interesting because I kind of forget, because you see him on the battlefield and you see him on the website and you see all those things, but you forget how secretive they are really within the 40K lore, and the fact that the battle group commander of all of the space fleets that have come together to protect this coral engine, even he's not heard of them. You know,
happens. We all know how what happens with those exposed to the truth of the Grey Knights. It's like they don't have a little Men in Black widget that they can what's that little memory thing, you know, the thing they
flashy thing. Yeah,
yeah, the little flashy thing. No, they just have bolt guns and storm bolters.
Yes. Side cannons,
absolutely.
Yeah, no, so yeah, it's good to have those little reminders that, you know, this is the world we live in 40K.
So there's the scene, that's the kind of the context, and you've got this flagship of Chaos, the Stygian Heart, on its little mission to Malak Bail, and alongside it, you know, it's attacking the astropathic hub fortress, and which is where the coral engine is, and then Angron also kind of gets involved, and effectively, you know, the Grey Knights rock up and say, something pretty bad's going to happen, guys, like, let's get the defenses on the go. So they all rock up, and the Chaos fleet turns up, and they're kind of like, you know, they're kind of doing well and defending it, and then Angron kind of arrives with his whole like World Eaters battle fleet. And it's interesting, there's a quote in there that says, only a mad or reckless shipmaster would risk translating from the warp beyond a system's mandible point. For to do so, chances emerging within a planet or star and thus suffering a truly horrible end. So I love the idea that like Angron's World Eater fleet kind of almost plays like chicken with the warp, but just like materializes into real space, just, you know, super close to the planets, and you know, sort of crazy like danger close planetary assault. So that's
kind,
cool.
Kind of like the Point Break parachute jump.
Exactly that. Absolutely that. Absolutely that. And the original Point Break, of course.
Oh, yes. The only one, really.
The only one. They did not make any others, ever. So that's cool. That's the kind of context. So you do get a cool, you get lots of, like, kind of void battles going on, lots of planetary sieges going on, and then Angron himself kind of makes planetfall and goes ham on the defenders of the planet. And this is where I think there's a big chunk of the book in the middle where, you know, you've got a great build up, a great context. And for me, I think the narrative is I don't want to say it's one dimensional, but it does get a little bit samey for me personally. You know, it's like Angron hit this, you know, Angron hit that and Angron was very angry. And then he hit this with an axe and then he hit this with a sword or whatever. For me, once he kind of started making Planetfall, you see him kind of make an assault on an orbital fortress. And it is so cool to read that as like, he's kind of like a one man army or one demon Primarch army. And that in itself is, for me, sufficient amounts of that story is sufficient amounts of violence in the book. So all the stuff preceding where he's like, you know, destroying a whole load of other bits, it's kind of like, oh cool, yeah, that happened again. Although I should say, the description of him effectively acting as a boarding torpedo himself was pretty fun.
Yeah, I think I agree in that because of his nature and because we you're halfway through the story, you know he's not going to send back into the warp realm of chaos halfway through. So that sense of jeopardy isn't there. I know, you know, and I think for me, I think he, you know, at some stage as he's making Planetfall, you know, he's not in a dropship, he's just falling through himself. He gets whacked by an orbital laser, which is described as almost cutting him in half, but it doesn't. Now, I think some of his, you know, proper godlike powers are actually, unlike when the emissions from the Corolla engine are actually dispelling and sending demons back to the warp, because it's so kind of pure in its nature, I think for me what it does to Angron is it actually kind of fuels him, and that it makes him so angry that this thing is there and existing and doing what it's doing. I don't think it actually harms him. I think it actually makes him more powerful. And I think the problem we have there is that I just believe he's unstoppable. And I think,
just to disagree with you slightly, Steve, like it does describe him as kind of faltering and kind of being weakened and being battered by the Coral Engine's, you know, power. So I don't necessarily think it does kind of make him stronger. I think it enrages him, which he then draws strength from that rage. So it's not the Coral Engine itself that makes him stronger, is it?
No, I see what you're saying. Exactly. Yes, I think it is that. And I think for me, because he becomes such of the focus, like you said, I don't feel that it's creating other places for me to game or explore in. I mean, we get mentions of Imperial Fists going into this ship or ship.
And Sons of Medusa. In that same paragraph, why would you bring up the Imperial Fist when you could perfectly easily bring up the Sons of Medusa, who we all know are very cool, bright green with white hats.
So you've got that in double yellow highlighter now in your book, haven't you?
Double green highlighter, thank you.
Double green.
With white at the top.
So I think for me, that there's lots of cool things in here. I just think I kind of missed in the past when we've had these opportunities of small, you know, we just get told of whole regiments of guard being, you know, laid to waste, and it's like, just give them a name. I'd like, sometimes even the name of a regiment can be enough for you to go, oh, I wonder where they come from, I wonder how they're armed, I wonder how, what they're doing, you know what I mean? I think it just comes a little top level, maybe, this book.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it goes back to my point about having human stories and relatable things, is that the story is centered around a demigod, an immortal demigod. And as you say, like, he gets zapped with all these like planetary defense lasers and kind of like gets blasted, not like back into the warp, but like his body gets almost eviscerated and evaporated, whatever the word is. But then like immediately rematerializes through the power of rage, you know, the power of Gorn. So you're almost like, well, he's literally unkillable. And
I think that battle you're talking about there is actually quite cool. And
no, it is cool, but like, you don't necessarily get a sense of, I personally don't feel like a sense of risk, a sense of danger, because the whole book is about him. And you kind of, I don't know, like, I know the plot armor's, I'm an R-ing here. Like, it's a cool story. I don't feel the human connection to the character. That's all. So it's not that the story's bad. It's that I personally don't find that human connection. And you are right, because it is so, like, it is all about a demigod laying waste to a whole planet. You don't get to hear about like the 103rd, you know, Malak Bale dragoons who, you know, fight on camels or something like that. You know, that's just not a thing. So you don't, you hear about like 17 regiments immediately being evaporated in a fire of blood. But I'd quite like to know all, you know, the names of all 17 regiments and the names of their, you know, commanding officers, you know, favorite goldfish and stuff like that. That's what, that's the kind of detail we like. And actually, notably absent is a lot of like breakout boxes, our little breakout boxes that we like. There's not a huge amount of these in the book, which is often where you find the most, for me, the most interesting little snippets.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that, you know, it, so does it drive the whole story forward? Yes, it does. You know, is it a cool story? Yes, it is. I guess for me, it's, is it a narrative book to dive into? And I think that also then is like the second half of the book, which is what we'll talk about in a minute, which is the new rules and the new missions and stuff like that. And are they, is it really, I'm going to be a broken record here, but, you know, I think that the beauty of the original Vigilis books were true narrative books, and that we still had a massive story, and we still had a, you know, Abaddon turned up, so we still had a massive warlord, huge hero turn up, but we still had all these other little places described, all these other regiments, these sort of other little fights going on, all these other locations. And I think that that's what I feel for me and how I play is kind of missing here.
Yeah, I'm with you. So, just kind of moving on with the narrative itself, Angron makes planetfall, and he's absolutely wrecking face. And meanwhile, the Stygian Heart and the cowardly Chaos scourged warband are like, all right, cool, sod this, we're out of here. And they're kind of pondering slash half escaping. And that's when Vashtal rocks up and is like, get back into the fight, my dudes. And kind of like, machine possesses their ship.
Yeah.
I think that's, for me, this is the coolest bit, is the development of Vashtal as a character. And it's interesting that he basically, you know, he kind of hijacks this ship whilst they're still on it and locks them out. You know, he plays all havoc with the doors and, you know, locks them out. And he's kind of like, oh, I quite like these guys who are, you know, fighting against me so aggressively. You know, maybe they'll be a useful little tool. And he kind of like magics away a group called the Tome Keepers. And you just think that like, oh, that's interesting. You're starting to see, you know, him kind of be like, oh, I quite like these Zinchi lot. Like, they're cool. And hide them away for another day. And you just think like, what little chess pieces, what little army list is he writing in the background? And what for?
I think we're definitely beginning to see, I think he's going to be a bigger player than this sort of quiet little ally to Abaddon that, as he appeared, has basically kind of said, hey dude, I can fix your ship and I can sort a few things out for you, and hey, I know the locations of some stuff you might like, you know, rather than being this sort of fixer character. I think he's going to end up being
he's definitely going to be more than an NPC, isn't he?
exactly, we're definitely going to remember his name, not that guy from the bar.
With Vashtal kind of like turning the ship around and getting back into the fight, meanwhile you've got Angron going absolutely crazy on the planet surface of Malak Bale, and he basically gets to the kind of the center of the coral engine,
but not before Imegna, the Inquisitor, she basically has to tie up all of the Admec advisors.
I love this. Yeah,
basically she says, you know, we're in trouble here. Take out all of the safety. All the limiters. Safeguards. Yeah, all the limiters off. Take all the safeguards off. Literally, pull all the fuses out. Just let this thing do what
just
it
like
needs
ramp
to do.
This up to 11 and 12 and 13 and like all the. So I love it. It's like the rest of a Magnus. This is Inquisitor Gloria Magna, who's a Ordo. What's she? Ordo Xenos or something like that?
Yes.
I think so. But yeah, she's an Inquisitor. She's discovered this core engine. And initially everyone was like, no, don't switch it on, it could be crazy, you know, whatever. But she's like, no, it's pure, it's not chaos tainted or whatever. So they switch it on and it's acting as like a kind of like mini Astronomicon and all that jazz, like we said. And then, you know, Angron and the World Eaters are charging their way towards this thing. And they're like, we've got to switch off all the safeties. And the Admech like, no, don't do it. Don't, you'll be crazy. Says, the rest of Imagna's small private army held at gunpoint, the horrified tech magi, dissuading them from interfering with this reckless act of tech heresy. The Martian priests cried out for the Inquisitor to stop, but their pleas fell on deaf ears. And Magda was convinced that the light of the God Emperor was the last best weapon in her arsenal. She had decreed that it would shine out as brightly as it could. And this is the best bit in the book, I think, is the sort of death of her as a character.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the best bit, but it's also the most hilarious, ridiculous bit. But it's very 40k. So at this point, the core engine switches on, goes all the way up to 11. Zaps almost every single, basic demon,
yeah,
off the planet and out of the system, and until it's only Angron and his obviously eight bloodthirsters, and the kind of like the poetic narrative epithets of like eight bloodthirsters and 8 hours, and it took them 8 days and eight this whatever, classic Wolfie McWolferson, Angron rocks up and he's just having like everyone. You know, all the Grey Knights, all the planetary defense systems, yeah, all smashing him full of bullets. And he's just like, he's just about to have that kind of like moment of being banished. But then the bloodthirsters rock up and they're like, nah, we got this. We're Angron's bodyguard. And one of the bloodthirsters uses his whip and whips it around the Inquisitor and like grabs her from the engine and flicks her like out, you know, into the sky. And it says, still yelling rites of abjuration and firing her bolt pistol into the bloodthirster's face, the Inquisitor was borne through the air to meet the swing of the demon's axe. Her head tumbled hundreds of feet to the ground below, its expression still one of zealous wrath, even in death. And I just love the fact that she's like, you know, manning this like weird core engine thing, like, more power, more power. And the bloodthirster like whips her off and she's like, yep, I'm going to have the clarity of purpose and mind to, as I'm being whipped off, to shoot a bloodthirster with my bolt pistol. Oh, genius bit of writing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you want. That's what you want.
And the Grey Knight Captain as well. It's quite funny because like you've in the kind of satellite, you've had this Grey Knight Captain that rocks up and the Inquisitor and all these kind of really important characters. And,
but he's kind of a named dude, isn't he? Crom.
Well, he's named in this book. He's not like a named dude. Like, he's not like a special character in the book, in the Codex, is he?
No, but he's definitely been named before.
Oh, yeah. So he's the leader of the little Grey Knight kind of detachment here. He gets, you know, he gets Angron, he gets an axe to the face. The Inquisitor gets like bloodthirster whipped and then axe to the face. And even the kind of like the Admiral gets murderated later down the line by the murder curse.
Yes.
Tell us about the murder curse, Steve.
Well, with the Grey Knights dealt with, the Inquisitor in multiple parts scattered around, Angron smashes the Choral Engine. And it's not just a big explosion. It's literally breaks the planet in half. Billions die at that moment. And there's this huge explosion that goes out, this kind of wave of energy. And it's this energy which affects whatever's left alive, gets hit by the murder curse. So it's basically everyone becomes a berserker, basically. Now, obviously not all of them have got axes and armor and all that stuff. So they may just be flying a ship. They may be doing anything. It's literally, everyone goes crazy. So it's a cool idea. I like it.
And it gives this this great little double page snippet of these eight murders. And so in the book, you know, Angron like smashes his axe towards the kind of heart of the machine, and you know, just as it's like a molecule away from breaking, he kind of gets like this weird, like not a flashback, but this like weird moment where he kind of like perceives the world through Korn's eyes and feels like every single murder that happened at that single point. So like when his axe fell on the machine, every single murder across the galaxy that happened at that point of like every single knife that went across the throat, every single shiv that went into a back, every single like power fist that went down into, you know, like all this kind of violence he kind of perceives across the galaxy in this like single moment of like mind-blowing kind of perception. Even to the point that it says like the butcher's nails still in his head. And I think like it was again a very cool moment. And again, like as I say, like the sort of middle bit of the book of him just going crazy and killing stuff, not that exciting. This is really intriguing. It's like, okay, cool. Like, what, you know, tell us about those little murders. Like, you know, it's got this double page spread of 8 murders that all happened. Obviously it's 8 murders that all happened, and then it goes on to the rest of the story. But it's really cool to kind of think about like how actually even the forces of the Imperium who might be, you know, conducting murder on the behalf of the Imperium and therefore kind of going ahead with spreading the light of the Imperium to the darkened corners is like, obviously that they are still slaying blood, you know, slaying their enemies and spilling blood. And as we well know, Khorne cares not from whence the blood flows.
Exactly. There's a really cool one because I'm enjoying my Enforcers in Necromunda at the moment. And this one here says, 3 of the gang are dead. The Enforcer killed them with a shotgun. Cold-blooded executions all. So that goes back to exactly what you're saying, Dan. It says, but the Enforcer didn't get Gorv. And now he's sprawled on his back in slump filth beneath the runoff downpour, and Gorv is straddling his chest. Through his shattered visor, the Enforcer locks eyes with Gorv. Expression utterly unrepentant. With a howl of loss and pain, Gorv brings his hatchet down with both hands and buries it in the Enforcer's face. So, yeah, like you say, I mean, this is a really cool moment there of what the murder curse is doing.
Yeah, and I think that then gives you the, like, those human stories that we've been missing, I think, from the book.
Yeah.
And then the book then sort of goes on, I think, like, it's in almost like the last pages about the murder curse before kind of it goes on to the Vashtor bit right at the end, which is almost like the epilogue. It tells you about all these, like, it's almost like a little cyclical thing of it says like, oh, the Astra Militarum, we're about to, you know, we're killing everyone and each other, but then this happened and like a tank rocks up and a tank's shooting people and they're shooting their own friends, but then the plane shoots the tank and then someone shoots the plane down and the plane crashes into a building and then a Titan shoots the building and then someone shoots the Titan. And it kind of just is this big like circle of like this cycle almost of violence. And it talks about like a, you know, a sister of battle. It talks about at the end, an ultramarine and all these kind of like noble warriors of the Imperium, like succumbing to the murder curse. And again, this is where my little mind starts racing. I think like, okay, cool. So what hobby ideas can this give us? Like, what would be a really cool way to take a non-Chaos army and make it like be suffered for the murder curse? So you could do, obviously, something like Astra Militarum. You could take all the like the Renegade Guard models from Kill Team and Blackstone Fortress and some of the old Forge World Uptaker kits and kind of paint them sort of red. And they could be, or like, you could paint them as like Cadians, but then like, have loads of blood all over them.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's nice. That's nice.
Rather than actually paint them like Chaos, you paint them as if they've fallen to Chaos, like there and then.
Yes, yes. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, I think for me, it's that you capturing that moment of change would be cool, because it goes on to talk about the fall of the whole fleet and kind of qualifies in one of the box outs that 80% of the battle groups fell to the curse. It was only the Grey Knights, Sisters of Silence, and the Custodians that proved truly immune. And so at a stroke, the Indomitus fleet, Quadtrus, was not only mortally wounded, but much of its still colossal strength turned traitor.
So,
bingo,
like,
you know.
What would, like, traitor Sisters of Battle look like?
Yes.
And there's a few, I think there's a few, like, of the Age of Sigmar Slaves of Darkness kits that come with like female heads. There's plenty of female heads in Warcry and stuff like that. So you could do a really cool Sisters Battle army with lots of kind of head swaps from like Warcry models and Age of Sigmar heads and stuff like that. And just kind of like, even like, they've got very like iconic hairstyles, obviously, the Sisters Battle. So even if you put like female heads that don't have those hairstyles on, I think that's enough to make them kind of lose a little bit of their purity, sort of the purity look. Yeah. You know, mixing things up, like having I don't know, like instead of the Sisters of Battle flamer, you could use like the warp flamer from the Thousand Suns kit, you know, that kind of stuff, just to kind of like turn a little bit of the models kind of into something a bit more chaosy.
Yeah. I mean, it talks about psychosis and mutation as part of the car mind shockwave, as they call it. So yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, I wonder if we're going to see this fleet return as part of another arc. You know, is it going to join with another one? We don't know. I mean, that's, or is it just going to stay there out in the dark reaches of the warp, only to appear at another time? So yeah, I really like that idea. And I think even fun stuff, like, you know, maybe you could do like a breacher team, because they would be something perhaps on board one of the ships that's been overtaken. You know, they survived the fight, but they've been overtaken. Even if you started fusing them with sort of Dark Mechanicum pieces, that might be interesting. You know, maybe they start working with Vashtor.
Yeah.
Because we see Vashtor beginning to collect useful components or trinkets, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, I think that's a fun way to look at this. I think fun way to sort of spin it out into narrative stuff.
Definitely. And then I suppose finally, from a narrative point of view, you've got, I suppose, the point of the book, and essentially the reason Vashtor rocked up and took control of the Stygian Heart is because Angron is clearly just this big distraction, kind of distraction carnifex, if you will, but Demon Primarch. And with the destruction of the Coral Engine, basically the whole planet shatters. Angron is like vaporized back into the warp, and the planet explodes. Even like it talks about like a huge chunk of the planet like smashing into another planet in the system, and just like immediately, like within moments, the, you know, it's kind of like a world-ending impact of like a chunk of a planet hitting the other planet. And I love that. That's really cool. In fact, it reminds me of the you know how like on Reddit you hear about like the Lord of the Rings, like why didn't they just use the eagles to do that? All these kind of like fan theories that are kind of like questioning the realism things. There's one of them which is about like the scientific impact of blowing up the Death Star in Return of the Jedi so close to like the moon of Endor.
Yeah.
And it's all about like, you know, such a like a rich planet, you know, the rich jungle planet of Endor, the forest planet of Endor. It's indeed the moon of Endor, is it not? It's not the planet itself. But anyway, it talks about like the kind of like the scientific impact of blowing up a, you know, low orbit space station. About like all these like the raining debris, the kind of like forest fires, and like how quickly the atmosphere would just turn to, you know, to be vaporized and all that stuff. So yeah, have a look at that, like scientific impact of the, I think it's like the Endor apocalypse or something like that.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Also, when you're talking about the explosion, the planet exploding, we also get to see a little bit more of Vashtor's power, because he's on the Stygian Heart, the Ark, but he's actually manipulating parts of it to become kind of like ablative armor to all these kind of bits of planet that are coming towards him, and bits of wreckage, because he wants to move into the center of the devastation. So, you know, he is, you know, he's more than a man with a spanner.
Yeah, I think that's quite a cool, it gives me kind of like Magneto vibes. You know, when like Magneto is kind of like flying, because he's not flying, is he? He's kind of using the magnetic fields to suspend himself slowly. It gives me that kind of vibes of like, I think, I can't remember which one of the X-Men films it is, but when he's like hovering above the humans, and he's got like this kind of debris cloud of metal around him, that's cool. And then also it talks about him like using parts of the ship as like a staircase, and basically like the staircase forming up in front of him and then like dissolving behind him to then form up in front of him again. That's obviously a really cool kind of narrative trope that's been used in other media as well. Yeah, so like he kind of comes into his own here and kind of reveals what he's actually after, and it is this like it's one of the, you know, it's the magical MacGuffins for the keystone, or whatever, the key fragments, and it's this like black rock within the center of the planet that's, you know, old as heck. And he basically smashes that apart, grabs it, and then bops out, goes into the warp portal.
Yeah, and that's really, every arc has its
as we discussed. Yeah, it's this little escape hatch back into the of, you know, his workshop. So he essentially uses Zangron to crack open the planet and steals the yolk inside. Could have just done that. 30-second review done.
Yeah, exactly.
Angron, yeah, and you can't make an Angron without breaking an omelette or whatever.
But yeah, no, I thought that was a really good. It kind of wrapped up the whole story nicely and reminded us why we're all here. So yeah, and made him much more of an interesting character. And obviously, we know the model now, so and that's quite an imposing model. Actually, it's probably bigger than I imagined it was going to be before we saw it.
The Vashtor model.
Yeah,
I think it's really cool. I think one of the things that would look really cool is some Dark Mechanicus models. It'll be really interesting to see whether those are something that come out or whether that's something that maybe comes out in a kill team down the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if we were going to see a Dark Mechanicum range, I think we probably would have seen them previewed by now. Noting, of course, that during the Las Vegas Open, they showed us the box that he's going to be in, and he's in a box with a whole bunch of Chaos Marine stuff.
Yes.
So my view is that if we were going to get Dark Mechanicum, he wouldn't be in a box with, what is it, Chaos Cultists, a Venom Crawler, and two Obliterators and Vashtor against the new Dark Angels Azrael with 10 Intercessors and a squad of 5 Deathwing Terminators. And I kind of figured, like, if we were going to see Dark Mechanicum stuff, we would see it now.
True.
But there's nothing wrong with, you know, the cultist models, and the cultists have obviously got a whole bunch of cool stuff in the new Chaos Marines Codex. So if you wanted to do a Dark Mechanicum army, then there's loads of scope there to do that with conversions and using the Forge Rod kits, like the Forge Rod Mechanicum stuff from 30K. You know, that kit bashed with some of the Chaos Cultist models would look really cool. You know, even things like, I've seen loads of really cool, like, Admech conversions of Cordor from Necromunda as well.
Yes, they will work great.
Yeah, I've seen those used for kind of Chaos Cultists in general, but also specifically Dark Mechanicum, because they've got those kind of hoods as well.
And they've already got guns in their hands as well. So quick swap rounds there with some heavier ordnance would be fine, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Really cool. And then kind of going towards the kind of rules element of the book, we've also got these special rules for the boarding actions.
I guess this was a surprise for me anyway, in the we kind of got given super simple stripped down set of rules for boarding action. I think for me that was refreshing, and I've had a couple of games and it's really good fun. It takes a lot of complexity out. But then interestingly here for boarding actions, we now have a bunch of extra rules, which is specific stratagems. And to be fair, I mean, it's not like a codex. You've not got 4 pages of these. I think that some of the main focuses might get 5 or 6 stratagems, but many factions only get 1 stratagem. And we do see something which I kind of like, which is the kind of restrictions on what you can bring is finessed slightly for some of the armies, because I think the original rules, I'm not saying made some factions unplayable, but you kind of had to keep your cool toys at home, if that makes sense, Dan.
Yeah. So do you want to give us some examples?
Things like World Eaters. So we've got these special rules. So we've got rules adaptations, enhancements, but it's this kind of top level mustering a boarding patrol. When mustering a boarding patrol, if your faction is World Eaters, then the following rules apply when adding units to your boarding party detachment. And they take priority over the normal rules for mustering a boarding patrol. So you can include 1 fast attack unit. So remember, that's not an option normally if you're playing the core set of boarding action, but only if it is a Chaos Spawn unit. Secondly, you cannot include more cultist units than Khorne Berserker units. And the last one is, when forming boarding squads, do not split cultist units into separate units.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because that's kind of mimicked, mirrored across in the Chaos Space Marines. So again, it says all Legion units in your boarding patrol must be from the same Legion. You can include 1 fast attack, but only if it's a Chaos Spawn. You can include up to 2 HQ units and up to 2 character models, as opposed to 1, but only if one of them is a Dark Commune unit, i.e. the kind of cultist units. Yeah. You can include more cultist units than traitor Astartes Corps units, but no more than twice as many cultist units as you have traitor Astartes Corps infantry units. So slightly different to the World Eaters. You can't include more. You can include more, but not more than double. And interestingly, you cannot include more than one model equipped with the Balefire Tome.
Okay. So that makes sense. It's just a bit of...
You know, a bit of balancing.
Bit of give and take, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. You can, if you include Possessed, it can only have a starting strength of 5 models. Can't add to it. When forming boarding squads, you can't split cultist mob units into separate units. And accursed cultist units must form boarding squads. When they do so, split the unit so that all mutants are in one unit and all the torments are in another unit. So that's quite cool. And then moving on to, you also get Space Marines. So again, all have to be in the same chapter. You can use, interesting, you could have a Lord of War, but only if it's a Primarch unit.
Right.
So that's interesting. Not only if it's Rabuto Gilliman, but only if it's a Primarch unit.
Ooh.
So what other Loyalist Primarchs are there, Steve? Well, interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We have to return to that.
We may, perhaps we, I think they've just that left that one lying around, haven't they?
Yes, yes, they have.
So you can include a fast attack unit, but only if it's an assault squad and they don't get jump packs, or if it's Fenris and Wolves, love it. You can include one heavy support unit, but only if it's a Hellblaster squad or a Eradicator squad. So we've gone from like the core rules being like, you can only have this, to like, you can only have this, but also this, this, and this, this, which... I do quite like that. I do like that they're kind of adding kind of some of the kind of elite infantry, heavy infantry in. So that's cool. And then those heavy support units, Hellblasters, Eradicators. Well, if the Hellblaster squad, you can only have 5 models, fine. You can add, you can only add one company veterans unit to your boarding patrol captain if it includes one captain model, fine. You can only add one servitors unit if your boarding patrol includes a tech marine model. Cool. And then we've also got Grey Knights. You can have interceptors and Tech Marine with servitors, fine. And you can't have the Wisdom of the Prognosticars upgrade. Astra Militarum, what can you get there?
So you can include up to 3 character models, but only one of these can have a wound characteristic of 5 or more. Attaché models can be added to a command squad to increase their size above 5, but no more than one attaché model can be added to each command squad. When forming boarding parties, do not split such units into separate units. You can only add one Minotaurum Servitor unit if your boarding party patrol detachment includes an Engine Seer model. And when forming boarding party squads, do not split infantry squads into separate units. So, again, I think it's just a neat way of adding some flavor and stopping things getting broken. So, yeah. I like them.
Yeah. And then the last one is orcs. All have to be from the same clan. Fine. You can have 2 character models, but only if one's a runt herd. And you can't include more than one runt herd character model, which is interesting because then it then has a little restriction on Gretchen as well. So you can only include one Gretchen unit. So you can't split them. You can include one heavy support, but only if it's flash gits. And you can include up to 2 units of megalobs as well. And the restriction there is also you can only upgrade one model to have a custom job. So yeah, that's cool. I think Gazgul and megalobs. What's that in terms of points? That would be cool. That's like all of the points. But like that would be a cool little like kind of semi Terminator Space Hulk force, right?
Yeah. No, that would work. That would work.
Gazgul, Thraka, Meganobs. Okay, that's 27 power level.
Ooh.
So we're kind of looking at 25, aren't we?
Yeah. Although, talk to your friend and I'm sure we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus it's points, and the points have changed, you know, recently. So who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. I just wanted to point out to the extra boarding stratagems that you get. To me personally, I as much as stratagems can slow the game down, and I can see why if I was a serious match player that it's almost impossible to know all of them for all the armies to know what I'm facing. And I appreciate that the bloat of where we are right now. Personally, I think if I've built my army narratively and there is a stratagem that allows them to do something cool, I think I'd like to keep them as some way. until that end, one of the Astra Militarum boarding action stratagems that you get is called Heads Down. So for one CP, ordered to hit the deck and aim from a prone position, Astra Militarum soldiers allow the members, other members of their platoon to shoot over their heads. So you can imagine opening some blast doors and it's kind of literally first rank fire, second rank fire, or first unit fire, second unit fire. So the exact rules are, use this stratagem in your shooting phase, select one Astra Militarum core unit from your army. Till the end of the phase, models in that unit are ignored for the purpose of determining visibility for models in other friendly units. So I thought, for me, that's cool. I like that. I think that's fun. And I think if you were and remember, units can't be split. So there'll be, that's 20 lots of guys. And especially when you start getting into these corridors and doorways, you know, there's absolutely reduces the number of shots going down. And when you've got armies that rely on lots of shots to cause lots of saves on high, you know, high saving armies, that something like that, I thought was really good fun. I quite like that.
Yeah, no, I do like that. It's quite cool, isn't it? We talked about how it'd be really cool to use like what do we have? Like, I think it was a Lord of Contagion. We talked about like a Death Guard kind of teleporting in, and we realized actually the Lord of Contagion doesn't have that rule. But there's the Orcs have a teleporter stratagem. Use the stratagem during deployment. Select one Orcs unit from your army. You can set this unit up on a teleporter pad instead of setting it up on the battlefield.
Nice.
So if you don't have that rule kind of baked into your war scroll, you can then use that CP, for example, which is quite cool.
Yeah.
So there we have it. That is the Arcs of Omen Abaddon Ashes of the Imperium review. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we'd be really interested to hear what you guys think of the book. So leave us a comment on YouTube if you listen to this on YouTube, or on Spotify or Anchor or however you like, on Twitter and Instagram. What do you think of the book? What do you think of the narrative? Were there any specific bits you really liked or disliked? And what are your favorite rules as well? And more importantly, what faction are you looking forward to having rules for boarding actions in the next book? So you can get us on at AOTI40K on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and soon to be TikTok as well. So until next time, keep calm and crusade on.
Cheers, guys.